Hi. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, August 7th, 1996. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Jack Nelson Pallmeyer. Today, he will be continuing his series entitled, Is the Religious Right Wrong About Family Values? Today's session number is 7, and is titled, Myths and Meanness, Blaming the Poor, Part 1. Let's listen in.
My name is Jack Nelson Pallmeyer, and this is part of a series on Is the Religious Right Wrong About Family Values? And this is number 3. How many are here for the first time? Quite a few. That's great. Thank you. Thank you for coming. Seeing all of you in here reminds me of a story of a friend of mine who was like me. Did a lot of work and does a lot of work on hunger issues and tries to get congregations concerned about hunger. And some of you who have maybe done that work know it's not always easy to get people interested in hunger and to come to forums. And she went to this fairly large and wealthy congregation that didn't have a history of being involved in issues like hunger. And she got there and it was kind of like this. People were trying to get in, and it was just great. She just couldn't believe all the people that were there, and they were craning their necks to see. And then someone in the congregation stood up and said, we're sorry to tell you that the forum on investments will be next week. And there they were. They were all stuck. And they had to hear a presentation on hunger. So God works in mysterious ways. Well, thank you for being here. I'll just do a very quick review of some of the things that we talked about last time and introduce you to this circle. And basically what we've been talking about is how the well-being of children and families really depends upon all of these circles and their interaction with each other. And one of those circles is what happens within a family. Is a family strong? Is its value system good? Are children treated well? Do parents or parent have time for the children? Are they being taught good values? A whole lot of things go on in this family circle. Some of us who know or who have been part of dysfunctional families know that impacts all areas of our life. And many of us know from experience that if we have a reasonably secure family base, it can help us deal with broader issues in the society. Well, the second circle is the neighborhood circle. We're going to talk a little bit about that tonight. But basically, that it's very important where we live, what our neighborhoods are like. And I said that I think, just upon reflection, most of us, or many of us, have had the power to choose where we live. And we've made some choices about that, probably for fairly good reasons, which would be an indication that most of us internally know that neighborhood is important, right, in the well-being of children. And I pointed out last time that it's probably important for us to acknowledge that even being able to choose where we live indicates that we do have some power. Okay? So neighborhood. We're going to talk a little bit about neighborhood in a minute. And then the third circle is the broader society. It has a tremendous impact on children, on families, on my ability and your ability to parent well, or other people, really depends in part upon the social context in which we live. And the neighborhood is part of that context, but so is the broader society. And I've divided society into 3 main groups. One is what happens to the economy. We're going to deal with that in a lot more detail next time, looking at the welfare debate about welfare reform in the context of what's going on economically in the country. Another piece of the society are government priorities and programs. And I mentioned last time, and maybe I'll give you the statistics again later, just how poorly the United States does relative to other countries in terms of lifting children out of poverty, or all kinds of social indicators of social well-being, economic well-being. We don't do very well. We're going to talk about about why tonight a little bit and quite a bit more next time. And then cultural influences. We talked a little bit last time about television, movies. I gave a translation of 1 Timothy 1. Jesus came into the world to save those, to save sinners is what we have in our Bible. That's fine. But a friend of mine, Walter Wink, a New Testament scholar, translates that as Jesus Christ came into the world to save those who have missed the point of living. And so we talked last time about what is the point of living? What are the things that we really want our children to know, to learn? What's important in life? How do we make decisions? And then we evaluated a little bit the kinds of decisions we do make and how that impacts children. And I mentioned then that my basic premise, which I argue in this book or lay out in this book, Families Valued, which you'll find in the bookstore. And by the way, I'll just make a plug for it because probably what you don't buy, I'll end up carrying on the boat with me. So it's a really, anybody want to speak about this book? No.
I've read it.
She's read it.
I am reading it. It's a good book.
All right. See, there we go. I'll give you your ice cream after. We'll meet the president's plan. Okay. But my basic premise is that we've allowed the religious right to dominate the debate about family values. And that values are very, very important. But in that discussion, it seems to me, has oftentimes emerged a very mean-spirited politics. And I am deeply troubled by that. And my own view is, if we take what is going on with children and families seriously, it will require us to change many, many things. Many things in terms of the personal choices that we make, the family choices we make, but also many of the social and political and economic priorities of the country will have to be different if we really want to value children and families. So that's my basic premise, and that kind of catches some of you up a little bit on some of the things that we've talked about. Well, where I'd like to begin tonight is I would like us to think just for a few minutes, and I'm going to have you do this in a turn to another person or small group, and preferably, again, don't get with your spouse or don't get with your significant other. Get with somebody that you don't know. We're not going to spend a lot of time in small groups tonight, in part because a lot of people have to leave at 7 o'clock. But I want you just to assess a little bit where you live and why you live there. And in particular, I want you to assess where you live and why you live there in terms of, is it a healthy place for children and why? In your neighborhood or community, what are the resources that you can draw on for your children? Or what isn't there that you hoped would be there? Or what do you feel is missing? Because I talked last time about how there's a kind of eerie parallel between children who are abandoned to mean streets and children who are abandoned to Nintendo. In the same way, I would say, there's a little bit of an eerie parallel for me in terms of my own experience. In my own experience, I now live in an urban center, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. But I grew up in a suburban context, and my parents moved there for lots of reasons, including they wanted me to be safe, they wanted a lot of things for me. But in the move that we made to the nicer suburb, what got eliminated in my life was a sense of community, a real sense of neighborhood. So I don't just assume that the suburbs are the best place to raise children. There are different issues there. But I want you to give an honest assessment of where you live, why you've chosen to live there, what are the resources that you can draw on that are healthy for children, and what are some of the needs or gaps that you feel exist. And we're only going to take about 6 minutes to do that. So you're going to have to be really articulate and clear with each other, okay? And don't get in big groups. Get with like one other person or maybe two other people. Okay? On your mark. Getting you thinking about the neighborhood as being important. But let's just see if a couple people will very quickly offer, just say something about where you live, why you chose to live there. What are the resources that are available, and what are some of the gaps? Yes?
We moved from San Diego to southwestern Washington. We were able to transfer with my husband's company because we felt we were raising a young family. We wanted to take the kids out of the Southern California environment. We moved into a small town called Camas, close-knit community, Milltown, since the 1880s, but which is now is experiencing explosive growth, the whole county, due to high-tech industry settling down. So there is a lot of the development we saw in Southern California that we were trying to get away is not going to happen, including gang activity, not in our area, but it is there. So we moved into a neighborhood that has been there for 18 years. We formed a crime watch. We formed the neighbor association. We worked very closely with city officials, with the police department, and crime rate is very low there. But I would say it's, you have to, my belief is that do not take it for granted. You have to keep on working at it constantly. So
it seems like wherever we are, wherever we live, whatever context in which we live, the need to be organized as a community is very important. Anybody want, maybe one other person willing to share where you live, why you've chosen to live there, what are some of the gaps you find, what are some of the healthy things for families and children?
The school's close by.
Okay.
It seems like a safe neighborhood.
Is it a small town? Is it a urban center? Is it?
It's right in the city, and it's a city of now about 60,000.
About 60,000.
45, you know, at that time. But a safe neighborhood, seems like lots of children, and the best elementary school that I could find in the city.
Okay. So you made some choices about schools, place, etc. Okay, well, yeah, go ahead.
I think in our case, we intentionally chose to stay where we are for this, placing the value of diversity and various forms of stimulation, intellectual and others, over safety factors. Seeing living in the south side of Chicago is not a safe place. Mm-hmm. That's a lesser value than the other concerns that are important to us.
Okay. Good. I think it's very important that we think about this question of location. In part, again, just to reiterate, because there really is power in the choosing. That's one. A second thing that I would stress is that because of this factor, there's no place to hide anymore. I mean, I think, and because of the cultural influences, you can be in a nice neighborhood that's safe, and our children still are not safe from our own definitions of the good life if they're misplaced. Or society's values, television, movies, all of those cultural things are still there. Just two quotes that come to mind that I would ask you to ponder on your own. The first is Alan Durning, who I'll talk about later, who works with an environmental organization called World Watch. He notes how a sense of community is unraveling in all places around the country, largely due to changes in the economy and our definition of economics. But he points out in that context, U.S. families move on the average of every 5 years, and he says neighborhoods have become little more than places to sleep. Now that was my experience in the suburb where my parents moved to because it was a nicer suburb. Is there was no sense of relationship or community. Some of that took place at the local church, but in terms of the actual neighborhood, all of that had broken down by virtue of how busy people were, how fearful they were, all of those things. There was not a sense of community. So that's one image. The second one comes from Jonathan Kozel, and he has a wonderful book. I forget the title, but I cited in here. That's one of them, and this is a different one.
Amazing Grace.
Amazing Grace, yes, thank you. And he notes, for example, that 3/4 of the inmates in New York State prisons come from the same 7 neighborhoods. Think of that. 3/4 of those who fill New York State prisons come from the same 7 neighborhoods. So think about that in a context of the impact that poverty is having on families and communities. And then he has this wonderful quote that I'd like to share with you about the breakdown of the family. He says, "The statement heard so often now is to assume the character of incantation, that embattled neighborhoods like the South Bronx have undergone a breakdown of the family upsets many women that I know. Not because they think it is not true, but because those who repeat this phrase, often in an unkind and censorious way, do so with no reference to the absolute collapse of almost every other form of life-affirming institution in the same communities. Perhaps this is one reason why so much of the debate about the breakdown of the family has a note of the unreal or incomplete. Of course the family structure breaks down in a place like the South Bronx, says a white minister who works in one of New York City's poorest neighborhoods. Everything breaks down in a place like this. The pipes break down, the phone breaks down, the electricity and heat break down, the spirit breaks down, the body breaks down. Why wouldn't the family break down also? I think that's a very kind of helpful corrective. Okay. Well, I want to shift gears a little bit, but it's really not too much. And I want to start getting into this, what I'm calling blaming the poor. It seems to me that anyone, well, I'll just recite this from a friend of mine and someone I've had the privilege of knowing a little bit, at least in my context of living and working in Central America, is a Jesuit priest by the name of John Sobrino. And you may remember that in November 1989, six Jesuit priests were taken from the Catholic University where they lived and worked and brutally murdered by U.S.-trained forces, almost all of whom, Peter and I will talk about this on Thursday night's forum, were trained at Fort Benning, Georgia, at the School of the Americas. John Sobrino would have been murdered too, but he happened to be out of the country at that time. Well, one of the things that he has said that makes a lot of sense to me is he said, anyone who idealizes poverty or the poor has spent time around neither. He says, poverty is ugly, and it does awful things to people and communities. We should never idealize it. We should always recognize that poverty means death. Now, having said that, I'm very concerned that we have grown up in a society that I think used to have some measure of sympathy for the poor. And I feel a fundamental shift going on where now, not only don't we have sympathy, but basically we're saying the poor are responsible for their own plight and they're bringing the country down with them. They're responsible for tearing the fabric of the country down. And we're going to talk about that over the next couple of sessions in terms of the welfare reform debate. But just a couple of quotes and things that feed this politics of meanness, in my view. Rush Limbaugh says on his radio program, quote, "The poor in this country are the biggest piglets at the mother pig in her nipples. The poor give nothing back, nothing." Then he goes on to say, another one of, there's a whole book of Rush Limbaugh misstatements. I forget who has done it. Someone probably knows that. But he goes on to say, the poor in this country live like kings compared to those who live in Europe. So the poor in this country are better off than middle class citizens in Europe.
That's not true.
It's not true at all. That's my point. Penelope Leach, who I talked about last time, has a wonderful quote which I have in this book in which she says, in fact, if you look at the poor in the United States relative to the poor in Europe, here they are really cold and hungry poor. And that's over 40 million U.S. citizens who are cold and hungry poor. One other thing, just one other example of what's feeding what I regard to be a kind of mean politics and mean-spiritedness towards the poor, or an example of it. In the November 1994 elections, according to an exit poll conducted by Harvard, I think it was Harvard University that I cite in this book, nearly half of the voters who voted in the November 1994 election believed that either welfare or foreign aid were the number one items in the federal budget in terms of money outlaid. Okay, that either welfare or foreign aid were the number one, the big expense items in terms of the federal government. Almost half of the people who voted believe that. In fact, each of them is less than 1% of the federal budget. Now, but I would have you keep in mind, if you believe that, if you really believe that all of our money was going there, it might help make sense out of the kind of political scene that I see taking shape. Okay, one other important quote, and then just a couple of comments before I want to ask a question. We won't do it in small groups, we'll do it in bigger groups. But I have a quote from President Clinton, who says something very important here, but it raises some interesting questions. He says, quote, "We have to face the fact that we have the highest murder rate in the world and that our children are more at risk here than they would be in most other countries and in all other industrial countries." Now, that's true. We have to face the fact that we have the highest murder rate in the world and that our children are more at risk here than they would be in most other countries and in all other advanced countries. Now, the question we have to ask is why? Why is that true? Last time I told you that in Sweden, after the government intervenes, for every 100 children who start out in poverty, less than 10 remain poor. In the United States, after the government intervenes, for every 100 children who live in poverty, 93 remain poor.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, at least in Germany, I'm German, there are some very good programs, apprenticeship programs, and that really help you. You don't have to have a college education, but right. In order to learn a job thoroughly and then get a good job.
And Germany is another good example. Germany does a much better job. France does a much better job.
It's
Canada does a better job.
Government and businesses. So.
Okay. So I think what I would like to pose, and she has started this process, is for us to think about why is that true? Why are 19 out of 20 young people who are murdered in the industrialized world from the United States? 19 out of every 20 murders of young people in the industrial world are citizens of the United States. Why? Why in Australia are there 4 murders a year and over 20,000 in the U.S.? Why are we 200 times more likely to be victims of crime than our Japanese counterparts? 200 times. These are very, very important questions when we get at the issues of families. So what I'd like you to do is just, we won't do it in small groups, but let's just very quickly, let's get out some of the whys. Yeah, that you think.
Break it down, it very much breaks down to the first comment that you made about 75% of the population in the prisons going out of 7 neighborhoods. Most of the crime and murder that you're talking about is in fact originating in those neighborhoods also.
Okay, so that would speak to the fact that there is a social factor, a social dimension to these issues. And if we've got 3/4 of the prison inmates in New York State coming from 7 neighborhoods, it should say that there's something going on in those neighborhoods apart from who lives there, right? Yeah.
One thing, drugs.
Another.
Drugs. Foreign countries don't allow it. Here, we go after the little guy, but the fellows that carry the suitcases with $1 million in them, they don't get that.
Okay, so drugs is a big factor here, yeah.
Also, weapons are readily available to all the young people. You do not have the control.
Okay, gun control. How freely available guns are in this society. In Detroit, Michigan, there are 3 guns for every person. That's what I've heard. 3 guns for every person in Detroit. I'm going to see if there are some others. Others. What are some of the other reasons you think about?
Well, one idea I've thought about is that with an aging population, we live in California, and the school systems are really, they've gone down.
Underfunded.
Right, underfunded, and I think part of it is aging population being less willing to vote for bond issues, to build new schools, the crowd, there are overcrowded conditions, there's no counseling services available. I mean, it's just a mess.
Okay, so speaking from your experience in California, where the education system has really gone downhill in the last few years as a result of some tax revolts, and particularly as the population gets older, less likelihood of actually voting in the kinds of monies that would be needed to build good schools, I would think. Yeah.
The more capitalistic the society, the more stratified the people become within it, and the more have and have nots evolve.
Okay, within our capitalist society, it's getting more and more stratified, and the divisions between the rich and poor are dividing. I talked about that a little bit last time. I'm going to talk about that a lot more next time. I mentioned last time that the U.S. has by far and away the largest income gap between the rich and the poor, and it's growing faster here. We have, maybe someone has the exact figure. The last I remember is in Japan, the difference between corporate executives and the average worker, I think, is about 20 to 1 in terms of salary ratio. In the United States, it's 149 to 1. It's up to 200 now. Thank you.
My T-shirt has
it. We're number one, right? Oh, it does. Okay, there we go. We can now. Okay, you can look at that T-shirt afterwards, and we'll. Thank you. Go ahead.
Glorified violence in media.
Okay, glorified violence. I talked about that in my sermon last night about how pervasive violence is. So that's very much a part of our culture. And I will tell you that there's a lot of concern about people around the world that our number one export, in addition to weapons, is now violent films, violent movies, violent media. That's a real tragedy.
I think it goes beyond violence. There's the glorification of sexual promiscuity, glorification of drug use. It goes on and on.
Just consumerism.
Consumerism, yeah. Drug use, sexuality, all those images that we surround ourselves with in our children. Yeah, you've been trying to get in again. Yeah.
Well, just you have to be careful about strawman arguments about drugs when you think about Amsterdam, gun control and access to guns when you think about Switzerland being the most heavily armed country in the world per capita. Everyone has a fully automatic weapon in the household and they're required to be a member of the militia. And you also have to think about, like this lady just commented, the violence. Well, if nothing else, the United States is the media exporter of the world. We show these movies worldwide. So why do we still have such a disparity violence?
What I think, if I could take your comment, I would say, I mean, one of the things that gets us thinking about is the relationship between the availability of guns in the context of tremendous inequalities, in the context of lots of the other things that we're talking about. Thank you. Yeah?
Seeming inability or unwillingness to really look at problems, but rather to create a slogan which everybody believes and then act on that.
Yeah,
so that rather than really investigating why we have crime, and what's being done with welfare, we just say the mantra is almost everybody says, well, the welfare system totally failed. It's terrible, and we've got to do something about it.
Tomorrow I'm going to focus on the tremendous economic dislocations that took place, really accelerated in the 1980s and are continuing now, that have created an environment of insecurity felt by many, and how within that void it's very, very dangerous and very easy to focus attention on the most dysfunctional segment of the poor in our society as a way of taking attention away from who's designing our society. What are the rich doing? What does the tax system look like? What is their vision of economic growth and prosperity? Those are the questions that we should be talking about, and I think they get deflected by that kind of those rhetorical statements that you're talking about. Yes?
Just to pick up on that comment, I think that in America we also seem to have an ethos of rugged individualism where we, instead of taking problems to authorities, we don't trust authorities, and we like to go out and solve those problems ourselves. And a lot of times that connects up with the gun issue, that we'll go and deal with those problems with a gun or with some sort of personal physical violence. And sometimes I think that's connected up with a gender thing too. The guys have to go out and prove themselves.
Uh-huh.
Or,
and I think another thing that the individualism feeds is that it's probably easier to blame the poor than it is to look at social or society forces that may in fact impinge on my ability. Okay, before the people leave, I just want to make two more comments, and then we will continue a conversation, those of us who remain. Just, I put this word vision, and it's an interesting word, but two things that demonstrate for me the need for new vision. By the year 2050, according to Alan Durning of World Watch Institute, approximately 2050, if we continue with the globalization of the economy along the lines of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades, the North American Free Trade Agreement, those kind of agreements that we've had in the last couple of years, by the year 2050, half of the world's people will live in absolute poverty. Half of the world's people. And I don't even want to imagine what that world will be like to live in. The other statistic, we probably won't get there, but it's very illustrative, is that if we continue our present rate of incarcerating people, putting them in jail, by the year 2050, half of the U.S. population will be in jail. So it gives you an idea of where the present political discourse and is taking us. Okay, we need to let the staff people leave, and then we'll...
I heard that same with that everyone wants to be in jail or working for a jail.
Right, then we'll have a job, right? The rest of us will have a job. So we'll be in there.
Definitely already had more in jail than in college.
Oh, I have a statistic in here.
How many are in jail? Just the whole statewide population.
We're going to invest in this.
Oh, sorry. Yes, this is time for people who are going to the investment discussion next door. Okay. I ask people to move in a little bit if you want. It'll be a little easier to hear. And we had a question here, a comment, and then you had one. And then, yeah.
Such an emphasis on education, but to wanting to keep our children in school so very long, whether they're able to or even interested in it, wouldn't it be better if we would let them just have a trade, teach them a trade? We don't have very many people in the world who are honestly qualified to do a good trade.
But our woman friend who is from Germany will tell you that there are programs in European countries that are very much apprenticeship programs that assume that there are various skill levels that are needed in the society. But they also, I would say, generally that the Western European countries do a much better job of making education of all varieties available, basically free to all, because they believe that a well-educated citizenry is absolutely important for the well-being of people in the country. We have a very different approach, and we're moving in a very different direction, which is essentially the abandonment of public education, I see, in favor of letting those who can afford to get their kids into good schools, let them do that. I think that's a very, very dangerous road to travel. You wanted to make a comment.
Well, I was just wondering about our fast-paced, stress-oriented society, if we have become so busy that we have forgotten the issues. You know, that people just don't pay attention to the politics, to what's going on.
Well, I talk about that some in this book, of being a parent who is trying to take my children's needs seriously, who also realizes that we live in a world that's unraveling. And so life is really a balancing act of trying to take their needs seriously. And, you know, some of the time I feel like, oh my God, why did I have children? How could I have brought them into this world? Sometimes I feel like, geez, I'm not doing nearly enough in response to the environmental crisis. Sometimes I feel like, oh, I'm trying to do too much there, so I'm starting to neglect my own children. So that to take the time to pay attention to these political and economic issues that we'll be talking even more about next time, that's really hard for lots of families, given the reality of their lives and what they're up against. And if that's true, you know, for busy middle-class people, think about the number of women has tripled that now are working three jobs trying to survive in this society.
So that's a very, very helpful comment. Yes?
When you talk about the German school, the only right the student has is to go to the school the government says he goes to. That's the only right. He doesn't have a Supreme Court giving him all these other things.
I don't know
that's not the case. No.
They give you a test at a certain age, and that determines an awful lot.
No, you have three choices of school. You can't finish high school, you can't finish middle school, and you can't finish even at, I don't know, I think at about 14
years old. You're smart enough.
Yeah. Well, no, but it's a pretty good system, and there's some excellent trade schools, and there's some, it's a very good partnership between business. No, you're not, I mean, you are free to choose. Which jobs you want to be trained in.
Any other, maybe one or two more comments? Anybody else? Otherwise, I want to, go ahead. One more back here.
I'll make one comment. I've lived outside of the United States for probably about 13 years of my life. And one of the things that I've noticed about the European countries I've lived in is the homogeneity. And granted, there are a lot of immigrants, but I think really when we try to compare Norway to the United States, there's really something missing in that. And it's not just the size, but you know, Germany is the size of Oregon. And you have to look at how that population developed and occurred. And watching my friends' kids go through the German school system, it's phenomenally competitive. I mean, we don't want to over-idealize some of those. I've watched, you know, the selection process to go to the gymnasium or not go. And it's vicious. And you know, kids are committing suicide in Japan over their education system too. So I think we need to remember how those ethnic and racial societies do differ greatly to ours. And our policies are different. Our country was founded on, you know, states' rights versus some of these other things. So I think those all enter into the milieu.
Absolutely. And I really agree that we need to be respectful of those differences and we need to be careful not to idealize. But the point that I'm trying to make at this juncture, at least, is that there is a tremendous amount of social investment in children and families, education, and others. Now, I feel very, very much the same as you do about, I don't particularly want to emulate the Japanese school system. It's not at all what I would like. In fact, it's just too harsh and too competitive and too, because basically, I mean, one of the things that I'm asking us to think about, and we talked about last time, is what is the purpose of life? And what is it that we want for our children? And in fact, a lot of the things that we named last time, beyond the kind of essential material things that we need to live, were non-material things. They were relational goals. And I think that we need to really hold those up and move in a direction which affirms a lot of those. Yeah?
One comment on some of these other differences, which still point, you don't want to idealize, but you still need to recognize. Our company has divisions in Europe. And so some friends from San Diego moved to the division in Bogen, Germany. And I asked them, what do you think of Germany? The first comment was, it's so safe here. It's unbelievable. My wife and I can walk around downtown at night without being afraid. That's just the way it is there. Friends at the division in Singapore, you ask them, what's it like there? It's so safe here. Japan, same thing.
Yeah, well, the reason it's so safe in Singapore, you know, it was the drug capital of the world. Mm-hmm. Only 14 years ago, the drug capital of the world. And it's because they decided that they would have no more drugs. And they told everybody that came in the country, if you are found with drugs, you will be taken out and shot. And it took them 4 years. They shot everybody with drugs, whatever amount it was. This is absolute fact. There is no drugs in that country. It took 4 years for it to get around. But that is one extreme, that is an island and everything that they felt they went to. I mean, there's no judge, there's no jury.
It was absolute.
Well,
so it's an absolute society.
They also have TV cameras to make sure that they flush the public toilets, believe it or not.
Right.
They monitor stuff like that.
Right. But it's the extreme.
That's an extreme. I mean, that isn't true in Japan. That isn't true in Germany.
Singapore, that was wild.
Well, actually, that's what I was going to say was deterrence. That some people might say, why violence, why the murder rate, high murder rate is three strikes and you're out. You know, I'm just reading. I just think that some people would say deterrence, but I think that that starts way back in the first circle, which is family, and it maybe wouldn't be labeled deterrent, but it would be support, structure. But looking at the purposes or the reasons behind the crime versus the punishment for the crime.
Yeah, I don't think that there's any indication at all that three strikes and you're out, the death penalty, that any of those things are having any impact on criminal behavior. What is, again, if seven neighborhoods in New York are giving rise to 3/4 of all the inmates in New York State, it says something beyond deterrence. It says something about the social context.
Right, what you're talking about, a lot of people in the country would say, well, there's not enough punishment for what they do.
Right. Okay, well, what I want to do for just a few minutes is set the stage for the welfare debate conversation, which is next time. And the way I was going to do that, it was just to highlight very, very quickly five or six things that I glean from pieces of the biblical story that I think could really help us. And that if we ignore them, I think it helps explain maybe why we're in as bad a shape as we are. So if that's okay, let me just list them really, really quickly, and I'll do this briefly, and then we can have a little more time for general conversation again. But the first one is that from a biblical perspective, hunger and poverty are signs of a fundamental spiritual as well as economic crisis. So we should look at the fact that one out of every four children in our country are born into poverty as really a troubling sign. It's a kind of a signpost out there screaming to us to reevaluate social priorities. It's kind of an indictment of faith in economics. Second, from at least much of the biblical perspective, the way we should judge whether a society and an economy is working well or not is by what's happening to the poor, not what's happening to the rich. And if you want a wonderful kind of biblical conversation about that, look at Amos 6. And there's kind of a debate going on because the rich are saying to Amos, look, things are great. We're doing better here than the other nations. And Amos comes back and says, no, you're crushing the poor. You have the wrong lens on. And think about that in the context of, again, the 1980s, which saw over, 95% of the income gain in the 1980s went to the top 20% of the U.S. population, something like that. So, or the stock market is soaring out of control. An example, how many of you are from Montana? Anybody? There were some people here from Montana. Montana, in the last 10 years, is the state in the country with the fastest growing per capita income gains. At the same time, it's the state with the second fastest growth rate in child poverty. It's going on right at the same time. It's a very appropriate symbol of what's going on. A third thing that I think we should remember from a biblical perspective is that human beings are part of God's creation, and we should be evaluating what we do based on whether future generations are going to have the basis for decent living. In other words, we shouldn't be robbing future generations by how we live now. I'll probably talk a little bit next time or the time after about groups like World Watch Institute that say we have about 40 years to make a transition to sustainable societies. And if we're going to make that transition, they say, one of the things we're going to have to do is end poverty. Because although the rich do most of the damage to the environment, rich people are putting poor people in positions where they are destroying our common environment. So they say the world as we know it won't survive divided between rich and poor. Overcoming poverty has become an environmental necessity. What I would also suggest is that overcoming poverty has become a social necessity. My kids will not be safe in the neighborhood where I live unless there's greater justice. Your kids, no matter where you live, eventually will not be safe in a world in which half of the people are absolutely poor. We just won't be. So the environmental implications. Another question posed by the biblical writers is the one that Walter Wink again captures, I think, in that passage, Jesus Christ came into the world to save those who have missed the point of living, which is, do the economic priorities that we pursue encourage a rootedness in spirituality? Do they help us develop a sense of the spiritual, a sense of rootedness in something other than in the material realm? And I have this quote in my book. It's a very interesting quote from Victor Lebeau, who laid out, he was a retailing analyst, and after World War II, this is what he had to say about the direction our society had to go from the perspective of the market. He said, "Our enormously productive economy demands that we make consumption our way of life, that we convert the buying and use of goods into rituals, that we seek our spiritual, our ego satisfaction in consumption. We need things consumed, burned up, worn out, replaced, and discarded at an ever-increasing rate." Well, that was a pretty prophetic statement. It raises some profound questions. And then, finally, the one that I would like to lift up is the biblical concept of Jubilee. Now, if you're familiar with the Jubilee, it was it written about it in the Old Testament, and it describes how every 50 years, land was to be redistributed, and land was the principal wealth-producing resource of the time. It was linked to the sabbatical provisions, where every 7 years, debts were to be forgiven, slaves were to be freed. It's a really profound statement, I think, that we haven't really taken very seriously, because what it implies is that every human society will eventually generate too much inequality. However it's structured, who's ever in charge, whether communist or socialist or capitalist, we're going to eventually evolve into intolerable inequalities that are crushing people. And so it built in this framework, really, that every 7 years, and particularly on the 50th year, this major new opportunity, this major breaking out of the cycles of poverty. And I guess the question that I would like to leave with you to think about, and we can discuss this and other things for 10 minutes yet, but for next time is, what would the welfare debate look like in this country if it was rooted in the concept of Jubilee? And again, every time you think of the word Jubilee, think about breaking the cycles of poverty. New hope, new opportunity. It seems to me it would look very different. Yeah.
Yeah, Jack, as long as we recognize that the Israelite people didn't maintain Jubilee very much.
Right. No, it was clearly a concept. Some people say it was never enacted. Some people say that it may have been once. But what we have in Jesus' first sermon, very interestingly, at least as Luke presents it, Jesus' first sermon is the reading from Isaiah that announces freedom to the captives, you know, liberation to the oppressed, and announces the acceptable year of the Lord, the Jubilee. So Jesus, in terms of Luke, comes announcing a Jubilee. And further, Jesus, I think, enacts or lives out without having the institutional power to carry it out society-wide, in fact, is living out the Jubilee throughout his ministry. I mean, the Lord's Prayer, forgiveness of debts, daily food. He seems to have been working primarily among peasant populations and dealt with issues of sharing the produce of the land and the land. So you're absolutely right. It was not, it wasn't honored every 50 years. But we have, I think, profound connections with Jesus' own definition, actual practice in his ministry that's connected to Jubilee, to this vision.
How else can it work?
What's that?
How else can it work but Jubilee? How else can it work but a fresh start and a clean slate for people? The cycle is so deeply buried in
them. Well, I think that's a really important insight, because within the present political debate, that's certainly not there, that insight.
Has the Democratic convention taken place yet? That'd be an interesting plank we could go suggest it to.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they really get elected.
Yeah.
To address partially how it could work, among the Arctic and Pacific Northwest tribes, in some cases, there's a tradition of potlatch, where it would be a massive redistribution of wealth from individuals. If we look back to other signs where we had keeping social Darwinism, which was the last industrial age, the Gilded Age, where the robber barons was the common term, amassed these vast quantities of wealth. Well, at some point, they also gave a lot of that back to society. So we have the Carnegie Foundation, which is still in existence. What do we see coming out of some of the incredible wealth now that's being accumulated? What's more wealth?
Right. And
we see little of this distribution. We see little of this tradition of potlatch, so to speak.
Another book that I wrote that's in the bookstore is called Brave New World Order, and in that book I talk about three wealth transfers that took place in the 1980s, and one of the three unprecedented wealth transfers that took place in the world was the largest transfer of wealth in the history of this country from poor working class citizens to the upper 1-5% of the U.S. population. And in line with what you're saying, we maybe, you know, I'm not suggesting that we word for word implement the Jubilee. But certainly an example of the spirit of Jubilee, at least from my vantage point, would be progressive taxation, for example. By way of example, we used to, in as late as 1965, if you made any money that you made more than $400,000 in a year, got taxed at a 91% rate. Now, we've never had a maximum income in this country. But that was getting close, right? I mean, that was getting close to, I mean, if you're going to make huge amounts of money, okay, but most of that is going to return and be used for a social purpose. And I think I could do fairly well on $400,000 a year, by the way. So it's not like we're really inflicting suffering. Well, in between 1980 and 1985, that tax rate was reduced from 78%, it was down to that in 1980, down to 28% by 1985. And it was the principal vehicle for that wealth transformation upward. That seems to me to be absolutely in conflict with the spirit of Jubilee. Okay, other questions and comments about anything that we've talked about tonight? Again, keep in mind that next time we will focus on the welfare debate. Yes?
One thing I don't think was mentioned. There's a large part of our community is dropping off. And as the economy is moving, I mean, developing fast in new ways. And the faster it develops, the more people drop off. And, you know, some of these people have to learn to run a computer for their job. Well, some of these guys can't even fill out an application, and they have no intention. So they aren't needed in their home. So they move out, and so they get a little employed.
As an educator.
And
well, that's very, 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 very widespread.
Welfare makes this, helps to make this work.
So the economic dislocation of huge numbers of people, and as the economy gets more technological and more sophisticated, what we're seeing is that very good paying jobs are available for perhaps a quarter to maybe even, we could stretch it to say, a third of the U.S. population. But then you have huge, huge numbers of people that simply are not needed. And they're not needed in the global sense, either as producers or consumers. And that's a scary thought for me, because I see, well, I'll maybe end this with a story that I was in. Sarah, who's standing back there, she and I lived in Nicaragua for a number of years, and we still have quite a bit of contact there. And on a trip that I was there a couple of years ago, I was meeting with some of Nicaragua's richest people, and they were part of a business organization called COSEP, the Supreme Council of Private Enterprise. And they had been very, very much opposed to the revolution that took place in the 1980s that was redistributing land and carrying out literacy programs for the poor, many of them had fled to Miami, and they were supporters of the U.S.-backed Contras, and they were now back in power. An election had been held. The Revolutionary Party had been defeated. Their political coalition candidate was now in power, and they were feeling really, really good. Except they had come back from Miami, and what they had discovered is that the war had taken a huge toll on their country, and that one of the things that they noticed was the geographic buffers that had always separated the rich from the poor had now broken down. And so you had slums all over the place, and literally fairly much right next to the mansions of the rich were hovels of the poor, as people had fled both the war and fled some of the agricultural policies of the new government, being kind of driven off their land. Well, the question that these rich Nicaraguans were posing to the group I was with, the question was, they actually asked, how do we get rid of the poor? It wasn't how do we get rid of poverty. It was, how do we get rid of the poor? And I think, you know, they were more open about that than anyone else that I've ever had a meeting with. But I think that's kind of the unspoken question that's percolating throughout the global economy, is that huge numbers of people in our society simply are disposable. They are not needed in the production or the consumption of goods. And that raises some very, very profound questions. Yeah.
Just to tag on that, the most recent issue of Sojourners has a fascinating article called Olympic Medal, M-E-D-D-L-E, and it's a story of what Atlanta did to the poor to get ready for the Olympics. So it's not just in Nicaragua.
Right. No, that's what I'm suggesting. It is not just in Nicaragua.
It's a devastating story of what happened to the poor of Atlanta.
Okay, well, just to remind you that next time we're on again, for those of you who can come tomorrow night, same time, same place, and we'll take a critical look really at two things. We'll look at the welfare debate, but we'll look at the welfare debate particularly in the context of the economic changes that have been taking place, accelerating since the 1980s, as well as what some alternatives might really look like. Okay? So thank you very much for coming. It's great to have you. Thank you.